Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. This is the show where we speak to key thinkers about values. We'd love to update what these terms mean in 2017. I'm Alice Thwaite, and today I'm with Alberto Alemanio, academic, civic entrepreneur, and public interest lawyer. He is currently the Jean Monnet Professor of European Law at HEC Paris and Global Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law. In 2015, he was named Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum. He's the co-founder of the Good Lobby, which is a community where individuals can share their skills to lobby for the public interest. And on this theme, his book, Lobbying for Change, is out now in the English-speaking world. Welcome to the show, Alberto.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. So I'd actually like to start talking about dissatisfaction that we might have with modern-day living. You start off your book by saying that there's a lot of dissatisfaction despite the fact that we have a lot more healthcare, we live for longer compared to before. I don't suppose you could give us a bit more detail about the dissatisfaction that you personally have with the modern day world.
As many individuals today, I often wonder whether I can do better to connect my expertise, my talents, my passion to society. From an objective standpoint, we know that today in our democratic societies, we are extremely privileged because we tend to be quite richer, quite safer. Our expectancy, life expectancy, is also going up, but we are incredibly unable to actually take full advantage of our privileged position when it comes to address daily injustices or the growing levels of inequalities. When we look at the level of education, we can see that we are about to witness the largest acceleration in access to higher education today. So we never had so many people getting into higher education. We're getting more and more educated, and we have the possibility to create a lot of contents, a lot of ideas because of the technological revolution. But very often, we feel that we are mobilizing all these expertise and these opportunities not really to improve the lives of the less privileged, but just to make our own lives marginally more comfortable. And when it comes to the democratic process, we are enjoying many more opportunities than in the past to actually connect with our policymakers. There are so many avenues of participation that enable us to participate on the daily work of government, but we're just not really interested in it. And we have grown a bit cynical about our possibility to actually being heard into this process. So to sum up, I think we have never been in a better position, at least on paper, to improve our communities. Yet we are feeling increasingly powerless to actually doing so. We live in an era in which very often the market and the governments do decide for us. I call this being powerlessness by design. There are unaccountable algorithms that they basically nudge us to take decisions we are not even aware of taking. And this is paradoxically even further strengthening our feeling of powerlessness in the system. In the internet that was presented to us as the major democratizing force for empowering individuals by ensuring greater access to information and to reduce the cost to actually connect one another and therefore to organize and mobilize has not really delivered on that promise. Our digital existence has turned into an echo chamber. And there's a subject that this podcast is so interested in which we are incentivized to spend even more time with like-minded peers, and therefore we fail to penetrate other social bubbles that are often presented by fear and xenophobia. And this process is getting worse and worse, meaning that it is accelerating. But the level, overall level of awareness about the existence of these echo chambers, which are further strengthening our feeling of estrangement and for many people of cultural homelessness, meaning not feel part of a society, are getting even worse. And the dark side of this feeling of powerlessness is that too many individuals, we know from sociological and psychological studies, tend to fall on the extremes of the political spectrum as a result of their increasing feeling of homelessness, cultural homelessness into the system. You ask about my own story. How did I come to the realization of this paradox? The fact that
Sorry to interrupt you there, Alberto. It's more what would you consider to be what do you think is unequal about our society? How would you define equality? What kind of ideas would you be pushing towards with lobbying? That's really what I'm quite interested in. Mm.
Well, it is almost a truism to argue that we live in an age of inequality. All indicators suggest that our society is growing more unequal, meaning that the difference the difference of opportunities today are very much driven by the resources, the financial resources we have. In the past, financial resources enable individuals to buy fancy cars and nice holidays, but today they are a key factor in buying access to a good education, in buying access to good opportunities. And again, we know from research, in particular behavioral science, that our own mental bandwidth, meaning our capacity to take decisions, is very much shaped by the opportunity we had in younger age, and in particular by the overall social environment in which we've been growing up. Inequalities are there to stay, and they're getting worse. If you look at the last report by Oxfam in 2017, we could see that 8 individuals do control half of the wealth that is generated at the global level. What is wrong with this? Well, what is wrong is not necessarily the unequal economic distribution, but the fairness of that system. Meaning that today we know that citizens are extremely angry at the unfairness of a system in which access to resources define basically who you are. There is more social acceptance about inequalities, the fact that in a society you might have people earning more than others because they might deserve it or because they had the opportunity to have it. But what really is triggering a lot of concern is fairness. And that's exactly where my own work fits in, because most of this unfairness of the system has to do with what I call interest representation, meaning the ability of groups, ability of individuals to actually shape the decision-making process by having an undue influence on values like the quality of the food we eat or the quality of the air we breathe, but also on the source of energy we are actually consuming every day. Well, these decisions today are largely driven by few actors, mainly corporations, some other organized interests, who actually have a voice into the process, which is significantly louder than the voice of citizens, of other civil society organizations, who do not have the same ability, the same expertise, the same commitment to actually shape the process in a way that might neutralize and counter the undue influence of these voices. This, in the long run, is making the life of policymakers extremely difficult because they are not able to identify the public interest, meaning what is the best solution for ensuring a good quality of life for our society and identifying the future.
I've got two questions there, Alberto. One is probably more of a technical question, and the other is a bit more expansive. So the first is your definition of society. By society, in the context that you're speaking of, do you mean a global society or perhaps a society in a smaller community like a country or a city? So that's my first question, which is more technical. And then my second one is to expand a little bit more on this idea of money breeds inequality in terms of democracy rather than money meaning inequality of you can buy a PlayStation and I can't. To kind of talk about what that unequal aspect means to democracy, but it'd be good also to understand a bit more about what you mean by society as well.
It's a fantastic question because it will enable me to tell a bit more about the focus of my work and also of the book. The book itself has a universal appeal. It collects stories that come from all over the world, and therefore it refers to societies that in reality inhabit very different environments. They might be societies, communities existing at a very local level, but they might also have further links with regional entities and national, and then, of course, international, and therefore the overall society. So my message is pretty universal. The idea that citizens can actually gain a voice into the process at the local level. But if they do so and they actually share best practices and successful stories in shaping decision making at the regional, local, and national level, this might also have an impact at the international level. So I try to convey a message that is absolutely actionable at all different levels of government by trying to reconnect citizens with their policymakers, regardless at which level those policymakers do actually take decisions. And we increasingly live in a multi-layer, multi-level policy system, which decisions are taken at very different level of governments without citizens being necessarily aware that this is currently happening. So one of the messages of the book is currently to focus more on the literacy of citizens when it comes to understanding who is actually taking a decision affecting our life. Is it the mayor? Is it just the city area in which a particular citizens live, or is rather a regional or a national level that decision is currently taking place? You were asking me more about the democratizing challenge for lobbying, how we can enable more individuals to actually gain access to the lobbying toolbox, so to use the different level of participation.
It's more about how do you connect this idea of money and inequality being important for democracy, rather than, I think many people when they think about equality think about housing or something similar to that. So how do you separate out those two ideas and distinguish this idea of inequality being something which is actually all about, I mean, in some ways it's an obvious point, right? If you have more money, then the chances are you have greater access to world leaders. But just to expand on it a little bit more.
Yeah, well, historically, wealth enable individuals to actually obtain access to goods and therefore to improve their own well-being and, of course, the well-being of their communities if those individuals were somehow enlightened and philanthropic in their inspiration. But over time, we realized that the role of money and wealth in society also had an impact in relation to the democratic process. We live in societies in which access to data will determine the success of a new political ideas, and therefore will shape the policies that will affect millions of citizens. And I think the best example of the negative effect of access to information as a tool to gain power is represented by what is happening with data broker companies like Cambridge Analytica that are capable of collecting information on the internet and to instrumentalize those information by targeting the so-called low information voters, voters who form their own political views in a very short period of time and without necessarily fact-checking those information you're exposed to. I think this somehow epitomizes what is wrong with a system in which wealth, money, my gain, my buy, very sophisticated processes that shape the political and therefore the policy outcomes for society.
Okay, that's interesting. I'd like to talk a little bit more about this notion of powerlessness as well, because power is a big word that has many different ideas and meanings behind it. When you talk about empowering citizens and empowering people, what kind of power are these people going to expect? What kind of consequences will occur as part of this power? What does power mean to you, especially in terms of lobbying?
I think the starting point when looking at the notion of power today has to do with the democratic process. We often forget that in liberal democracies, the sovereignty of the people belongs to the people and is only delegated to our representatives who have to exercise that sovereignty, meaning the ability to take decisions into the system during a particular time frame, which is the electoral cycle. If we remember ourselves that we are the holders of sovereignty, we are always entitled to take decisions that are set to affect our own individual life, but also collective well-being. So that's what power is about, is first of all being aware that we have certain prerogatives. We are entitled to connect to our decision makers who on a temporary basis exercise power on our behalf and being able to make them accountable. The problem is that in our democratic process, the incentives for any elector to make their representative accountable in between elections, they are virtually inexistent, because our representative democracy has been created in a way as to free ourselves, citizens, in our daily life, of the responsibility of government. We are simply called upon to confirm whether our decision makers actually did a good job. And in that case, we're going to confirm them on the position. But we know from political science that our electoral behaviors, the way in which we actually engage with our electors, with our representatives, is no longer driven by output legitimacy. So verifying whether these individuals, whether our politicians did a good job, but is more driven by identity politics, is more driven by ideology, and is even more driven than in the past by our own perceptions of what these particular individuals could do for us. What is interesting from a research perspective is that all the societies that are inhabited by citizens that are assertive, that are not allegiant to the system, but they are absolutely aware of their own powers, of their own abilities to shape the policy process in between elections, they tend to be much more accountable. They tend to be more transparent, and in the long term, they also tend to be happier, meaning that the individual happiness of the citizens grows when they feel better represented by the policy process, because they are capable of actually exercising their individual power through the representative democracy.
So, just the way that I've then understood it, for you, power means this freedom of choice. But then it also means that once you make the decision, then you can check to see whether or not people have done the things that politicians have done, the things they've said they've done. And perhaps if we want to think a little bit more about this notion of power, it might be a little bit more separate from identity politics than the way that we're currently operating. Is that a good summary?
Absolutely.
Okay. My final question is, because when I was reading the book, which I would recommend, because I hope this isn't offensive, but it is an easy read. It's very easy to kind of get the ideas out from the book. But one of the key things that I was struck by was, if you are lobbying for something, let's say, you know, a debate that is going on in quite a lot of parts of the world is fracking. So there are some people who know that there's an energy crisis and are very pro-fracking. And then there are the people who don't want this happening in their backyard. Mm-hmm. So you could have these two different lobby groups that occur within a society, whether or not that's local or a national and international society. How within your framework of citizen lobbying, how would it work that these two groups could compromise and come together and create a solution that's beneficial for as many people as possible? What would be your take on that scenario?
Well, the notion of citizen lobbying builds upon the interest group theory that has been theorized by James Madison, Alexis de Tocqueville, Robert Dahl, according to which a fair society gives underrepresented groups more power. In other words, we have to make sure that everybody gets a seat at the table. So we have to make sure that the process will empower any group that is claiming a particular position on a policy debate to actually voice it rather than exiting. But today, most of the time, we know that the individuals who are sitting around the table, as we previously mentioned, they only represent certain interests. And they inevitably bias the whole policy debate. Citizen lobbying per se has to be neutral, meaning it has to be an instrument that can be used by citizens, by actors who have different takes on issues that are at the center of our democratic process. So in an issue which is as disputed as fracking, so the ability to basically extract shale gas from the rocks which are underneath the earth, well, in that particular instances, depending on the worldviews of the individuals who are, and also of their geographical locations, of their different economic interests, we can expect very different positioning, which will also be mediated by their political representatives, by their own other disintermediation bodies that might exist in their community. And what citizen lobbying does in that process is to stimulate a conversation about the merits and, of course, the disadvantages stemming from fracking, the introduction of fracking in that particular region, or, like it is happening now in the European Union, about the merits or whether of the imports of those products coming, for instance, from Canada, especially those gases that come from the sands, and which therefore are even more intrusive when it comes to their extraction. According to an understanding of citizen lobbying that I try to convey in the book, both those who are against it and those who are in favor should have the opportunity to have a conversation that will blend scientific research, how intrusive it really is, how long-term might be this effect, which are the economic advantages in terms of employment, in terms of opportunities for the territories deploying those non-conventional oil forms. Unfortunately, today we have very few instances in which the policy process is as informed has to allow everyone to actually get both sides of a particular story. We tend to live in a society in which the information is presented in a polarized ways, in a manner that prevents us from getting a full picture of which are the different pros and cons of the policy options which are on the table. In other words, citizen lobbying does not want to antagonize the political process. It wants to complement it by giving the voice to even more individuals, by making the system perhaps even more chaotic, even more turbulent, as it is often the case with citizen mobilizations, but richer, and certainly giving rise to a form of participation which is more thicker than the one that we currently see both on the digital and offline.
So I suppose what you're saying is, at the moment, we quite often have conversations which are quite binary. So it's like one group thinks this and another group thinks this. Whereas if more people get involved in this lobbying process, then we'll have perhaps a more comprehensive view of the issue, which will decrease polarization because it won't just be left versus right, black versus white, whatever. It will be something a little bit more inclusive. And that in itself could be a method of creating better communities.
That's absolutely correct. I think citizen lobbying has also plays a pedagogical function. I often say that citizens will learn from the process, probably more than from the outcome itself. So even if they won't be able to stop fracking, this might be the objective of their own endeavor, they will still have a lot to learn from the process because they will also be made humbler by the different trade-offs that policymakers face when discussing policy issues, by becoming part of the process, by following the conversation. They will fit that conversation, but they will also be exposed to a process that most of the citizens today are not necessarily aware of, even of their existence. And this pedagogical role of citizen lobbying, to me, is particularly important in today's society because it's absolutely lacking, given the fact that the policy process is pretty much today a top-down affair rather than a bottom-up one.
Okay, wonderful. To wrap things up then, Alberto, this is the Echo Chamber Club. We do try and challenge our listeners and the readers of the newsletter to read points of view which might sit outside of their echo chamber, which is in this case is kind of a liberal progressive echo chamber. What would you know, what's the one book, the one website, the one podcast that you'd recommend to our listeners that would make them see the world in a slightly different way?
Well, I think today we have many sources of information that are available on the internet, that are available on different sources. And the major tip I have for the listeners is to try to blend these different strands of literature, ideas, different communities, in order to build bridges among all these fantastic sources of information. That's what I've been trying to do when writing the book. I've been blending behavioral research with political science, with legal analysis and public policy, all kind of information that was relevant for my message has been put into the book. And I think each of us, in order to pierce those bubbles, actually should actually do so. And it's not impossible to do so by even forcing ourselves to read views we disagree with. I often read the Wall Street Journal just to get a sense of what my enemies do read and how their own information are shaped every day. There is in particular a book that I believe our listeners could benefit from. And this book is called Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, written by Moulay Anton and Shafir, an economist and another behavioral economist from Princeton and Harvard, who discuss how scarcity affects our daily lives. And they recount anecdotes of their own weaknesses and explaining how what at the end of the day makes a difference today is our own awareness of the limited ability we do have to take a fully informed decision, and how becoming aware of this is just the beginning of a journey to better understand the world and understand why many of citizens might not necessarily feel the same as we do, because their material conditions, their psychological conditions are absolutely driven by a different kind of frameworks and different kind of environments, which do manage scarcity in a different way. I think reading this book might be a game changer because it makes us much humbler when it comes to understanding the world, and it does so by focusing on the individual. But of course, the message of the book has greater and deeper implication for our understanding of society themselves.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Alberto. It's been really interesting chatting to you.
Thanks to you for having me.
So it was great to have Alberto Alemanho on the podcast today talking about inequality, lobbying and powerlessness. A reminder that all the links to the books that he mentioned will be on the website, that's echochamber.club. And don't forget that you can email me at editor@echochamber.club with any of your comments. I always reply and pass them on to the speakers and the interviewees. Just also to say that this podcast is different to our newsletter, which comes out every week, where we seek to strengthen any arguments and points of view that sit outside of the liberal, progressive echo chamber. And so please do sign up to that too. It's easily done on the website, echochamber.club. Finally, if you enjoy these podcasts, then please consider giving us a 5-star rating and telling everyone about us. We'd really appreciate it. I'm Alice Thwaite, and see you next time.